Welcome to the Young Association of Western Massachusetts. I said it right. The time change. It's very weird to me when the time changes. It's like everybody goes away and we'll play up the spring. So I'm glad you all came out. I need to speak up? Okay. Some things we have to talk about. Please, we appreciate your donation of $10 to help us fuel this little organization. If you cannot afford $10, we understand. And there is an email list. If you want to be on our email list, please write clearly so we can put your name in the system. And I have some brochures here. If anybody is coming down from Hilltown, it's hard for us to get up there. If you know a place to put up a brochure, we're trying to get, that's one of the ways we can, so just grab a brochure on your way out, or a couple of them, if anybody can do that.
Okay.
And this, how many people heard about this from a newspaper? Okay, we're trying to see where our efforts are going best. How many are on, got our email? Okay, any other interesting ways you heard about it? A person did you? The word is spreading. We're trying, what?
I just knew about it, so I checked the website for the schedule.
Great. How'd you hear about it?
It's originally from a friend.
Okay, great.
And you don't see a poster.
What? Did anybody see a flyer?
How many?
Little things, two people, three people. Okay. So the word is getting out. We're trying to create a community here. We're going to have a salon afterwards. If you'd like to come have a cup of tea and have some interesting talk conversation at the, where do we go? Mosaic Cafe on Gotham. Thank you. I'm glad I have people who know things here. Okay, so if anybody's interested in helping our organization, volunteering, do you have a gift of some kind or some way you might be able to help us, approach me and let me know. So this always happens on the first Friday of every month. I feel like I'm one of those people in the airplane. The exits are at this little hall. Okay. So the first Friday of every month, except January, it will be the 11th, which is a Sunday. We decided to try a Sunday thing in the middle of the winter, which is going to be me talking about the Dionysian women's initiation mysteries for men also. We decided to do a Sunday so people could come with 1:30 to 4:30, a little longer, so people could come and have brunch together or have dinner afterwards, so we could have a nice thing there. Okay, so tonight we will be recording Penny's lecture and people, and if you want to ask a question or say something that you don't want to be recorded, just say, please turn off the recorder and we will. And we have an archive where you can go and listen to the recordings that we've done so far. So we don't take a break, though Penny might need to take a break, she said. but if you need the bathroom, it's right over here. So just quietly go to the bathroom and come back. Next month, wonderful Thera Green is speaking on double trouble and relational healing. He always talks about double trouble of some kind. I'm sure it'll be great. We have some wonderful local analysts. Penny is one of them, Thera, Anita, Karen, myself. So you don't have to go to Boston to hear a wonderful Jungian analyst. We're all here. Jung says, and many other people say, there's a myth that somebody isn't good unless they're from far away. So that's a myth. Okay, so tomorrow Penny is doing a workshop. It's in 105 down the hall. If you would like to go, please make sure she knows that you're coming. There's a sign-up sheet right over here. A donation. I have it. I will put it over here. we ask. We're at Smith College, so we ask for donations. So we ask for donation of $35, right? $40. Thank you. And again, we really appreciate that you can really pay that for Penny's time and the room and things. But if you can't, we don't like. Also, we want people to be able to come. So, okay, so tonight we have Penny Tarasuk on dream animals, and I always remember Marie-Louise von Franz, one of the early analysts, who said, if you don't pay attention to the animals in fairy tales, you're in double trouble. So we're going to hear about the animals in dreams tonight. And Penny was the curriculum director of the Boston Jung Institute. She's a training analyst there on the faculty. And she is a woman of nature. And I have an image of Penny as a deep, quiet, deep well that I keep getting to know a little bit. And she's also very political. So let's welcome Penny.
Well, say some more about the political.
No, you can say some more about the political. Well, you're involved in the pipeline.
Oh, yeah.
Trying to stop the pipeline, for one thing.
Yeah.
Very important. So welcome, Penny.
Well, thank you for coming on a lovely November evening. Actually, it's really very mild. The first thing I want to do is say hello to you, and I'm sure many of you are very fond of various animals. Let me just quickly get a sense. How many people in the room have or had a dog? Wow! How many people have or had a cat? Wow. How many people have or had a bird? How many have or had a horse? A snake? A rabbit? Wow. A drill. Just so you know, it's estimated that there are about 75 million dogs and 90 million cats owned in the United States. So that means approximately 47% of all households in the United States have an animal. If you can't hear, let me know. I talk softly, but we've got all kinds of amplification. I want to thank you for the generosity and spirit of coming, and I want to thank the current and past board. Right now it's Erica Lorenz as president, formerly Karen Myers, and I think Thayer and Anita have been
off and on.
Off and on. We have Judy Hall, and we have Carol Bouvet, and Dan. And what's your last name?
Grunwald,
right. So I want to especially thank Dan for his tech assistance and just general support, and the beautiful poster and website that you've been doing, and Smith College kindly supports our use of the facilities, which is really lovely. And this evening I want to welcome you to an experience in depth psychology grounded in the work of Carl Jung. And I'm going to be relying particularly on the gifts of artists across time and with the support of technology. This is the modern day Hermes, and we will touch on the mystery of dreaming animals and animals dreaming. And most deeply, I want to offer gratitude for all those who have gone before, the ancestral spirits here, the indigenous humans, the two-leggeds, and all the creatures, legless, many legs, finned and feathered, Ionides, land, the sea, the sky, and all those beings living here now. May we learn to live together with greater sensitivity and interdependence. So the first thing I want to talk about is the elephant in the room. And I want you to know, I had a lot of fun writing all the metaphoric language. There are so many metaphors in our language that use animals, and maybe we can have a little playtime later for that. But the elephant in the room, I just want to acknowledge, is that the elephant is going extinct extraordinarily quickly. And the elephants that do exist, most of them have some form of PTSD because of loss of relational bonds. And they've, in many places, been living in terror. So I just want to say it's very important that you put some energy in the elephant and begin to take the elephant in the imaginal space, because that may be all that's really left. There are some sanctuaries, but the wild elephant that we've known, the dream of Buddha's mother, the white elephant, and related to Ganesh, that our elephant will be gone, as there will be many other extinctions, and it's happening so rapidly. Chimps, gorillas, lions, tigers, I could go on. Last week, the Dalai Lama was at MIT convening a large gathering concerning climate change and the development of global youth leadership. There was an auditorium with the Dalai Lama, spoke with MIT professors talking about climate change. In a parallel gymnasium, there were 700 young people, I think mainly young teenagers, and they were there, and he spent time with them, and he is working with youth on global leadership around education and environment. What the Dalai Lama kept coming back to over and over again was the interdependence of all life, that we're all related, and we're all on this planet together. And you really do need to understand that to develop compassion. And so that's part of my political work. Just very quickly, I began my Jungian studies in 1975 with a formal Jungian analysis, and that 39 years ago, I was one of the first four candidates, and I was one of the first two graduates of the Jung Institute of Boston. And I was a therapist before that, so I have worked with people for 45 years. Individuals, couples, families, groups, and particularly dream groups. I had a dream group in Santa Fe for over 11 years, and it's still going now. I became interested in the link between animal cruelty and human violence, and spent time in the community. I began coming out of my office, so to speak, and entering the homes of the far less privileged, helping with the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society. I helped formulate humane education, testified before government committees related to animal cruelty, participated in a disaster crisis. There were forest fires that came into Los Alamos, burned the town, came right up to the fences of the nuclear waste. Anyway, so the animals were evacuated, people and the animals were evacuated and held at the shelters, tents, you know, a whole evacuation thing, just like they do for people. And it was a while before people could come find their animals. And it was very touching to be able, I took a lot of photographs of, and I remember a physicist, tall, white-haired physicist, having a reunion with his dachshund. And people who'd lost their homes, but they came and they found their cat, and the whole family got to sit in the room with the cat. And that's all they had. Their home burned down. Anyway, that was, there's a great deal of care in New Mexico. There's also a lot of animal cruelty in New Mexico, as there is in many places. And I participated in hoarding cases where I went in with the staff and saw the conditions of utter chaos and cruelty. And it's something one doesn't wash away. I also was able to go to Alamogordo, where the chimpanzees were used for medical research. Now that has essentially stopped, but there has been an enormous amount of chimp research and research around drugs and around AIDS, et cetera. And I got to go to the chimp refuge in Florida, Carol Noon, who died about 2 years ago, rescued an enormous amount of the chimps who had been in captivity and had been, you know, abused and had been disrupted from family bonds, and there was a sanctuary there. There is also now several elephant sanctuaries in the United States and elsewhere. Chelsea Clinton went to see one of the sanctuaries in Indonesia, so it's very possible that there will be more action around certainly elephants if Hillary does come into office eventually. It might be a little late, but I really learned, you know, that the staffs of the animal shelters that take in thousands of animals are, there's a sort of post-traumatic effect for them, and that it was very important to work with them around debriefing and, you know, taking care of themselves. A teacher of mine who exemplifies compassion in action said, "Companion animals are one of the last true links to nature." It's really important. It really frightens me when I see, you know, robotic cats in nursing homes in Japan. Now, I don't know where else it's happening, but it really frightens me because these animals are one of our last true links to nature. And domestic animals live under our roofs and they eat with us. I've been in the presence of and witnessed many people's intimate treasures and sorrows. I've sat with horror stories, their dreams, their follies, their shame, and their prayers. It's a humbling and profound vocation, and I really know that. And I thank all the people I've worked with who've shared their lives, their inner lives, with me. I owe a great debt of appreciation to my family and many animals that I both had, lived with, and many who have fed my body, my heart, and my soul. So I dedicate this to the animals and the artists. And I'm hoping that when you leave tonight, that you'll take with you a strengthening of your own bond to nature, and maybe be a little bit inspired. Okay. I'm going to ask you to approach tonight as a meditation. I don't know if anyone was at the talk I gave 7 years ago, but some of the material is in here. But I go over and over this and teach it many times, and I'm always learning from the dreams, the images, the art, and the experience of getting ready to teach this. Why animals? Why dreaming animals? Nature is my passion. I am curious and in awe. And for me, creativity in any medium is an alpha and omega. Using poetry, photography of dances, photos, paintings, I can't say enough about the importance of nonverbal expression in and of itself as a means of bringing experience over from the unconscious and grounding it in this world, in the earthly world. I've grown to appreciate that so much of the work that must be done psychologically is below words. It's much more in a feeling state, and it's often located in the right hemisphere, and Anita will teach you much more about that. But it's below words and verbal communication. And art and other creative expression, imaginal expression, is essential for wholeness. Part two is going to be illustrating some of the thoughts with animal dreams from an 8-year analysis that I did with a remarkable, or I shared with a remarkable woman who was an artist. And I had the privilege of working with her up to and through her death and afterwards. And hopefully we'll have a little time for questions and answers, but there's so much. I've taught this for 8 weeks to the candidates, and I can only touch on a few animals tonight. We're going to have a lot more animals in the room tomorrow in the workshop, so I just want you to know there's so many animals to talk about. So first I'd like you to begin with a meditation to close your eyes and breathe. And just get grounded and relax. It's Friday night. You don't have to do anything except be here. And as you sit and breathe, maybe you could take a moment to remember the animals you've known, especially the ones you've known intimately. Now come back to your breath. Remember your body. How's your body feeling? How's your stomach feeling? How are your shoulders? You can move, you can stretch. And if at any point you need to get up and stretch or take a break, just be careful, but just take a break. And I want you to think about your wonderful mammalian body. Okay, come back to the room with us. This is a photo of a deer in a forest, and the deer is crossing our path. She is not on the same path as us. So I want you to imagine following a deer, or if another animal comes to you, follow that creature in tonight's presentation. From 40,000 years ago, 4,000, the Paleolithic era, we see evidence of deer in cave paintings at Lascaux, France, and in Indonesia. And we see it up to the moment. And I saw it in the visions of a dying woman just recently. The deer is sacred the world over to indigenous people, and she is a form of the goddess Artemis. She represents a creature of the earth that is swift, nearly silent, she can scream, and bird-like in movement of flight. I use the deer partially because she's the one who appears and disappears, much like what spiritual and numinous experience is like. It's a glimpse. It appears, if we're fortunate, we experience it, and it's gone. In Kundalini yoga, in very oversimplified terms, utilizing the breath and internal focused energy, one reaches various states of consciousness. Each of the 7 energy centers or chakras of the body is imaged in the literature. Not every one of them, but most of them have animals, symbols and animals. And the deer is pictured as dwelling in the heart chakra, the 5th chakra, the Anuttara. And the heart is the place where the experience of earthly life and spirit meet. It's the crossroads. It's the place of transformation, and it's the place of suffering and love. The divine appears and disappears like a dream. And the longer I work, the more it's clear to me that the heart is really, really the great gem, and that we need to complete this life through our heart, unburden our heart, and open our heart, because I do believe there's a birth through the heart. These are hoofprints in the Quabbin Reservoir. Carl Jung said, and this is from volume 10, dreams are impartial, spontaneous products of the unconscious psyche outside the control of the will. They're pure nature. They show us the unvarnished natural and are therefore fitted, as nothing else is, to give us back an attitude that accords with our basic human nature when our consciousness has strayed too far from its foundation. Our body is nature, and it's the foundation of consciousness. Our body is the foundation of our experience of psyche. We are mammals, and we forget this. We are dreaming animals, animals dreaming animals. We're visiting our kin and being in the web of relationship. Our ancestors dreamed the world and lived in what the Aboriginal people called the dream time. Aboriginal humans live closer to what we would call, what we would probably call a waking dream. These are cave paintings at Lascaux, France, and if you haven't seen Werner Herzog's film Cave of Forgotten Dreams, you might enjoy it. It's one of the few really in-depth looks in the cave, so it's beautiful photography. So this is from 40,000 years ago, and I have continued to meditate on the reality that this was a Paleolithic cousin of ours who saw a creatures, perhaps a deer ancestor, and carried this within his or her mind deep into the cave, perhaps a safer place, and then expressed it in lines and colors and perhaps ground stone, and reproduced through his or her mind onto the wall what we see in the present moment. This was the giving birth to the image in the form that we call art. And it never occurred, I mean, I slowly have been getting this, but I never really thought that a woman was one of those artists. It only dawned on me recently that, how do we know there weren't women artists in there? This is Aboriginal dancers. These are in Australia. The dancers are dressed like the animal and they assume the position. There's also forms of meditation where you move into the form or the posture of the animal while there's drumming and let that experience move through your consciousness. Here they're doing the deer dance. They enter a non-ordinary state of communication with a particular creature, getting ready for the hunt, and sometimes simply for gratitude. People relied on animals for survival, food, and the warmth of clothing. This is more contemporary. This is 1984. This is a Native American deer dance at the San Ildefonso Pueblo, which is south of Santa Fe, one of the 13 northern pueblos. Traditional dances continue to the present day. Each dance has a different theme related to the cycles of nature, and each dance tells a story of renewal. So they're enacting a creation myth, which is very healing for the community. They're a communal ritual and an expression of gratitude and communing with the earth and divinities. From little three-year-old children to very large elder men, the community circumnavigates dancing through and around the village with large drums beating and the older men singing chants, ancient chants, and the community dances for hours so that they are very much in a non-ordinary state. And sometimes it's a burning sun kind of day, it's really hot and they're really sweating. Sometimes there's mothers with children in their arms dancing. and they're dressed in furs and feathers and pine boughs. And this is usually followed by a feast where they go to their homes and they have prepared food probably for weeks, and they open their houses and one is invited to go in and share the meal. And it's extremely humbling. And I wish I could have seen even more. I saw the corn dance last. So what about dreaming animals? First, we're the family of mammals, which we often forget. And we pretending that we aren't kin has enormously negative consequences, the greatest of which is the loss of relationship, the loss of kinship. When we do not recognize the other as kin, we're more likely to degrade, enslave, dominate, ignore, and destroy the other. Certainly, we're likely to fail to recognize their lives as having inherent value beside our own narcissistic use of them. They are other nations, as Henry Beston said. They have in the past comforted us, companioned us, fed us, warmed us, clothed us. They worked for us, and they have participated in war for us. I'm thinking of particularly the dogs and the horses and the dolphins, among others. And I'm sure things were tested on the chimps as well. They submit to our research and contribute to the pharmaceutical industry. They bring us joy and awe. We owe them our reverence. It seems evident that animals may dream, and for all of you who have dogs, and there are most of you, you've seen them barking and yipping in their sleep. Dolphins don't sleep the same we do, that we do, but they rest different sections of their brain. The cetaceans, the whales and the dolphins, are the only conscious breathers on the planet, so they can never go fully to sleep or they drown. You can't anesthetize a dolphin or a whale. So if you do an experiment on them, they're conscious. Whales and dolphins live in a kind of waking dream. Could it be that we are the dreaming animal and the dreaming is really one of our most valuable gifts? It was often thought that the answers to various problems in tribes came through dreaming and dreamers. Indigenous societies valued dreams for their contribution to the well-being of the group, the tribe. In modern times, dreaming is largely devalued, ignored, and even mocked. Subcultures such as ours are an exception. Our individual dreams are truly uniquely ours. No one else can dream your dreams. The dominant culture prizes extroversion, aggression, and materiality, and the subtle gift of dreams is often overlooked and bypassed. Jung has stated that dreams are outside the control of the will. They seem to come from a realm of great mystery. Why do the animals appear in our dreams? These are just some points that I came up with, but I think this is relevant. Animal is body. We're dreaming animals. We're mammals. Animals and dreams carry our projections and shadow aspects of our ego. Dreaming animals reconnects us with our personal history.
Yeah.
I don't know if you can see this little guy, but this is a little stuffed horse companion. Maybe one of the first animals that many people have seen. So they reconnect us, dreaming animals reconnect us with our personal history, family history too, and prehistory, memory, complexes of basic experiences of attachment and loss, and species evolution. Animals are our relations, our relatives. Animals Journals and Dreams can function as teachers, guides, also known as psychopomps, and supporters, and sometimes they can be fierce, sometimes joyful, and sometimes delightful. Sometimes they're a bright shadow, they're qualities and energies that we are not aware we have in us. And the last point that I want to make is that dreaming animals can be a direct, personal, embodied experience of the divine, an epiphany of holy terror, numinous beauty and awe, or perhaps pure delight of nature. Such experiences are unmediated by priests, therapists, or any other external authorities. This is a human capacity and a birthright. This comes with our life. I've had lots of animals and helped several animals deliver puppies, that sort of thing. And when I was in labor with my first child, what came to me was the memory of my dog in labor. And it was as though, it's not that she was there, but my memory of the naturalness of it was very helpful. And that's also true. I also have experienced the birth and death of, I had a horse who gave birth to twins early, and hard as that was, I think I was being taught something. And many of you have been with your dogs when they died, or your cats, or were euthanized. So they often teach us some of the most profound transitional, they teach us a way for a profound transitional state. This is a pilot whale in Hawaii in the Pacific Ocean. So we're moving now into the great blue, and we approach what becomes awesome. The water is so deep and so clear that it's like being in outer space. It's like being inside liquid light. This dream was reported to me some years ago. I am swimming deep in the ocean, unaware that an enormous whale is behind me. Then I realize its presence. Then the sense of an entire seizure. There's no me. It's like being hit by lightning, eclipsed totally. Then the whale swims by peacefully. This is a watercolor that I did when I was 30, so this is 37 years ago, when I was in the early part of my Jungian analysis. And this is an example of a sleeping, I call it a sleeping bull, but it could be a cow. So it represents something sleeping in me at that time, perhaps repressed or denied power, perhaps repressed or unknown strength, virility, earthiness, and fertility. And this energy is in the unconscious, yet to be found. But it's available, and it's not so far away. The bull brings the discussion of sexual energy, brutishness, clumsiness, earth energy. And if you notice, there's the three colors of alchemy in this particular, I'm going to call it a bull. There's the black of the eyes and the horns, which is related to the negredo, or the earlier part of the work, depression or lead, the unconscious. Our work is to transform that, to know it and transform it. And the white is the albedo, which is the whitening or the silvering. It's the stage of many tears of purification and recollection. And the red is, and this is sort of emergent in this creature, more the completion of life, the Ruby Deo, I might be saying it wrong, the passion of life, the blood of life, the incarnation of the spirit here in this lifetime. So it was such a wonderful image for me. And during my analysis, I spent a lot of time drawing, painting my dreams. I really encourage it. Write poetry, dance, whatever, it helps. And my experience is that the psyche is organic. It is a living, I don't know if I'd say being or creature, but it's organic. If you take care of it, it responds, gives dreams, and leads you in other ways. So the dolphin turned out to be my psychopomp all the way through my training. The night before my interview in 1978, I had a dream where I was given an ancient tile, and on the tile was a dolphin. And it was like getting a postcard, only it was an ancient tile. So I talked about that in the interview. And they talked about the dolphin as a symbol of the womb. And the dolphin's also associated with the Temple of Delphi. And the words, "Know thyself," are etched above the entrance. And that's kind of the Alpha and the Omega, is know thyself. So I continued to dream of dolphins. This is in the middle of my analysis. I think this is somewhere in around 1983 or something. And I was coming out of the airplane. I was coming out of my head. I was coming down into the waters. I was coming down into being dissolved. And if you notice, it looked, you know, the plane is also known as the silver bird. So that's a creature of the air, so to speak. It looks like there was a fire. There was some kind of something very dramatic. And you see the velocity of the movement. And my clothes were torn off, so I had no persona. It was really like entering the womb of the ocean. It was a kind of rebirth going on. And I have flaming red hair there, kind of looks slightly like a mermaid. And my eyes are wide open, and I'm really reaching out for help. And I was met by a dolphin, and I held on in the dream, and the dolphin took me to an underground city. And there were people walking around, it was functioning just like a city. And I sort of, you know, didn't quite know what to do with this, but I learned later that in Celtic mythology, there's a city known as Yuz, Y-A, that has sunk to the bottom of the sea, and it's thought that when the feminine principle rules again, the city will rise up out of the sea. So I wanted to tell you a little bit about another artist, Meinrad Craighead. She was a nun, an artist, and she did quite a lot of shamanic dreaming. And I learned about her in the 1990s, and I really liked her artwork, and I asked her, could I use it in teaching? And she said, you can use anything you want. She currently lives in Albuquerque. She's about 77. She was born in Little Rock, Arkansas, and lived with her grandparents in the summer, and she was exceptionally close to her grandmother. She attended Catholic high school, went to a small Catholic college for women in Iowa, Then she got her MFA at University of Madison in Wisconsin. In 1960 to 62, she taught art in Albuquerque. Then she went to Europe on a Fulbright, and she entered in 1966 the Stanbrook Abbey, a Benedictine abbey, a contemplative monastery, and in 1972 took her final vows. She spent 14 years as a nun, and she had the good fortune that her gift of art was recognized, so they let her practice contemplative art. She expressed an early deep attraction to the Black Madonna. She made the difficult decision to leave the monastery in 1980 and return to Albuquerque, and she arrived with her dog, Erdemir. And the dog was the beginning of a 25-year lineage where every time, the dog would have puppies and whatnot, but 25 years. I'm going to finish reading her part before I read this. This is Meinrad talking about herself as a child. It was my seventh summer. I think everything and everyone slept that afternoon in North Little Rock. That day, the dusk, the sun were red. The roses were wide open. The hydrangeas open. And I lay with my dog in a cool place on the north side of my grandparents' clapboard house. The hydrangeas flourished there, shaded from the heat. The domed blue flowers were higher than our heads. I held the dog, stroking her into sleep, but she held my gaze. I watched the dog and she watched me, a balance of equal weights. I looked into her eyes as I knew that I would never travel farther than into this animal's eyes. They were deep, as bewildering, unattainable as the night sky. And just as mysterious was another movement, the rush of water deep within me, the sound in my ears resounding from my breast. I gazed into the dog's eyes and listened to the sound of the water inside, and I understood this is God. So this is Meinrad's artwork of her as a seven-year-old with the dog. But she's clearly has such a deep connection to nature and the Great Mother. I think the name of that particular book, of a retrospective of her work, is Crow Mother and the Dog God. So this is called Her Face. Carl Jung wrote in the Vision Seminars in 1930 to 34, and he's talking about one of his patients. She beheld what no man is meant to see, eyes full of woe and beauty and light, and now, when our patient has reached the animal level, one could say that she has undergone the essential experience of the Dionysian mysteries, which then forms a bridge between herself and the original primordial man, concealed beneath the historical layers of the past. And, let's see. So this is more of that vision seminar material. You remember that the purpose of the Dionysian mysteries was to bring people back to the animal, not what we commonly understand by that word, but to the animal within. She looks directly into the eyes of the animal, and they're full of woe and beauty because they contain the truth of life, an equal sum of pain and pleasure, the capacity for joy, and the capacity for suffering. No one could say one could say that these are the eyes of the beginning of the Creator. When our patient reached the level of the animal level, one could say she'd undergone the essential experience of the Dionysian Mysteries. This is such a convincing experience, that such an astonishing revelation, that it's uncanny and profound and contains absolute truth. She's touched the bottom and looked into the eyes of the animal, and the animal's soul has gone into her. She's been united with the animal, the deepest parts of the collective unconscious, and that is an unforgettable experience which will cling to her. This is Meinrad's image. This is called She Who Gives the Dream. And there you see, this is a lunar kind of image. And that's an angelic figure. Again, a winged mythical figure. There's the moon. And this is Meinrad sleeping, eyes closed, holding a turtle under her arms. And there's a lotus blooming. And it looks to me like that's kind of muddy. And she's being pressed down, held down by the angel. Then I noticed that there was this interesting similarity of both descending to the depths of the left in the picture, both with a winged being or form above. Mine is solar, that little picture up in the left is an attempt at the tile. By the way, the palace at Knossos had images of those dolphins. You can go see them. I didn't know that. But I, as I looked at these, I thought about the violence in mine, the speed and the violence and the velocity to, maybe that's the training. The training process, maybe that's what it is. But anyway, there's similarities and differences. And both have helping creatures. The esteemed scholar of old European archaeology and mythology of the goddess, Maria Gimbutas, tells us, at the core of prehistory loom the animal archetypes, symbols of fertility and death that stand beside the great mother in what can only be described as epiphany. Her animals are neither totems nor independent divinities of polytheistic belief. They embody the deity herself, defining her personality and exemplifying her power. Her sacred animals act in the myth as guides and soul carriers, much as they do in fairy tales and dreams. The appearance of animals in dreams indicates that one can experience life more fully in the flesh and blood, in the body, in this earthly embodiment, the incarnation of the spirit in flesh. We can awaken the companions and receive help in acknowledging our personal psychological history. How many of you had stuffed animals when you were younger? And even though they weren't flesh and blood, they were a beginning relationship. And my experience is many people who have particularly difficult early attachments in infancy and childhood, they have either stuffed animals, or they have animals in the house, or maybe they have a tree outside, but they actually keep their self with the big S safely held in the animal or in nature, because it wasn't safe. I'm not saying that that doesn't happen for everybody, but particularly when there's been a difficult beginning. And I've often thought, sometimes we're using the self and it's helping us and whatnot, but I think sometimes the self is actually using us as a vehicle, and we may not understand it. We may never understand it. So I wanted to talk some about the antidote to my 14 years of training as a Jungian analyst. I was actually out here visiting Edith Solwall. I don't know who knows her. I had my thesis which was on emergence from autism. And I was reviewing it, getting ready for my exams, and I was so tired, and we were sitting together, and I kind of threw the thesis down, and she said, "What do you really want to do?" And I said, "I want to lay in the sun and swim with dolphins." I didn't even know where that came from. And she said, "You have to do that." And I thought, "Yeah, right." So, when I finished my training, I had planned a week of rafting in New Mexico with a friend, and I got a catalog in the mail from Interface in Cambridge. Does anybody remember Interface? It was a kind of a humanistic psychology center, experiential. Anyway, there was a workshop advertised for a week in Key West, breathwork, and it was going to be also facilitated by dolphins, co-facilitated. And I thought, oh, well, I don't know about the breathwork, but I do want to go see the dolphins. So I went, and I began swimming with the dolphins. I swam at one of the research centers, one where the dolphins could leave anytime they wanted to. And then I began swimming in the wild, and have probably swam about 20 times at least in the Florida Keys and in the Caribbean and in Mexico and in Hawaii, especially Hawaii, lots and lots of Hawaii. So I went to this breathwork thing, and I had profoundly deep, I would call them active imagination experiences. And many of them had to do with integrating everything I had learned as a Jungian candidate. It was so integrated because the myths, the fairy tales, all of that came back to me, and they were embodied, and I had profound experiences. And being in the presence of a real dolphin in the water, they use sonar and they echolate you. So they're basically reading everything going on in your body, your heart rate, what you ate for lunch, if you're pregnant, if you have a tumor. And there was one woman in the group, and the dolphins were very interested in her breast, and she finally, later in the week, said, "Well, I had breast enhancement surgery." So they were very, they knew. They were very true. And I had read a paper on Betsy Smith, who was working with autistic children. She was an analyst. It was in some analytic journal. She was working with autistic children and dolphins. Number one, they're brilliant, and they don't get bored. So they keep creating games. So she was using, having dolphins help her to interact with autistic children. And the dolphins were extremely capable of keeping the child engaged. They also used dolphins with children who'd had multiple surgeries, and part of their body needed to be strengthened. So the dolphins, they loved bilateral symmetry. They actually would encourage the movement of that part of the body. So They're used in many ways. These are the gentle ways. So I continued. Actually, this was the picture of the dolphin that I swam with. And this was that gaze. This was that really wonderful experience. And I was swimming alongside of the dolphin, and it reached out with its caudal fin, and it took my hand. And I didn't realize until later, but if you look at the physiology of dolphins, they have these bones. And it was like bridging thousands of years, you know, interspecies, etc. But they really worked on me in the visit, and it was just extraordinary. And I have yet to meet anybody who didn't feel a certain sense of joy and awe in the presence. So I also wanted to say, this is a picture. I went kayaking in Baja, Mexico, and had whales on either side in the front and behind the two-person kayak. And I tell you, I was really praying because they were enormous. And it wasn't expected, it wasn't planned. So this is Baja, Mexico, and this is a gray whale. They look like dinosaurs. And they're very friendly, and many people go out in these little boats. And the people are really transformed by being in the presence of whales and dolphins. And recently, off Laguna Beach, California, 60 sperm whales, and that's extraordinary, 60 sperm whales gathered. And I don't know what they were meeting about, but there were dolphin watch boats out there. 60 sperm whales. And I heard some of the people interviewed, and there was a little girl who was about 10, and you know, she couldn't speak. She had just been in a state of awe. So I would say that I was really, I said it was an antidote. There was a lot of intellectual stimulation, a lot of verbal work, a lot of having to explain everything or make sense of everything, often through my mind. And it was wonderful to balance playing. There were a lot of the dolphin breathwork people were women, so I was playing with women. I was in the water, in my body, and I was doing art all the time. So it did act as an antidote to too much intellectual work all those years. So James Hillman wrote a little book called Dream Animals, and it's illustrated with artwork. And this is a quote from him, which I love. Animals wake up the imagination. You see a deer by the side of the road or geese flying over in formation, and you become hyper alert. I found that animal dreams can do the same thing. They wake people up. Animal dreams provoke feelings, get people interested, thinking, and curious. And as we get more into imagining, we become more animal-like. Not bestial, but more instinctively alive. And with more savvy, a keener nose, and a sharper ear. Jung said, the wise old man is really an ape. And this is Hillman again, and I love this. This is a continuation of that book. You know, people come to therapy really for a blessing. Not so much to fix what's broken as to get what's broken blessed. And in many cultures, animals do the blessing since they are the divinities. I don't fully agree that people just want a blessing to what's broken. But I do believe everybody wants to be blessed. So maybe we could have the lights up a little bit, Dan, and we'll come back into the darkness in a minute. But I just wanted to have you stand up and stretch and breathe a little bit. Don't leave the room unless you must. Bend your knees, breathe. Okay. Before I go into the second part, You can leave it up a little bit. I just wanted to know if there's any questions just right now before we go on.
I like them on as much as possible.
I know.
But that's just me too.
Okay, we'll leave you there for now. Boat, do you like it darker or lighter? Okay, we'll leave it lighter for a while. So in this second part, I just want to use some dreams from, mainly from an analyst, who I worked with for about 8 years. She's 56. She died at age 64, and I worked with her all the way. And like all of us, she had a personal language and array of landscapes and characters. And in dreams, animals, domesticated, wild, imaginal, and mythical, may appear. The dream may tell me what the analyst's ego, or the patient's ego, cannot. And I would say in my work that the psyche leads the way when I work. Dreams are extremely important and helpful in the process of individuation, the striving toward wholeness, and the work of completing a life. My experience is that people who do the work, and maybe that's partially lightening the heart, and who allow the psyche to help them, that completing life is that can actually be have a great deal of joy involved, even when it's earlier than you expected. This particular woman was exceptionally talented in art, and some of the dreams she had really felt like art. I worked with her and her husband and family the last 3 months of her life. They invited me to live with her. We had ended the analysis when she had her terminal diagnosis, and she and her husband asked me to come and live with them on and off, week on, week off, to help her die at home, which was her choice. She contracted hepatitis B and C when she was about 28 and had a radical mastectomy in one of the best hospitals in California. And they gave her a transfusion and gave her hepatitis B and C. This is before blood screen. So she lived with this fateful experience her whole life, and she lived very with great health. She took good care of herself. And finally, there was a liver tumor wrapped around her portal vein, so it could not be operated on. And she decided she would die at home, and she would do it her way, and it was, in many ways, a feast. So, in the beginning, I say this is exceptional. She kept 20 dreams of her journals over those 8 years, and she wrote notes after her sessions. I mean, maybe it was compulsive, but she was certainly a student of the psyche. And she asked if I wanted to use her work for teaching purposes and for encouraging other people, and I said, yes, I would love that. They gave me full permission to use her materials after her death, and I've just picked a couple of the dreams to share with you. And it's very clear, we had a very positive transference. She had, in many ways, lost her mother early. Her mother was kind of in and out of her life. But she had gone through major health issues. She had a schizophrenic, a son who up until 18 was relatively normal and was diagnosed with processed schizophrenia. And that was a kind of cross to bear in life. She had hospice, and it was a big transition to leave the analysis and to transition into being kind of part of a team of people working with her. But she never shared any more new dreams at the end, but would go over old dreams. And sometimes she would invite people who were in her dreams to come and sit and hear them. So it was like the dreams inner, you process it outer, and then you bring the friends in and you process it. I mean, it was just marvelous. People were always thrilled to be in her dreams. The dream she brought in her initial session was there was a black stone monolith in the earth, partially covered. The dream the night after her first session involved a dog. I'll read it to you. I look down and I see I'm naked. I move to the foot of the bed where I can see another room. A dog is there, very happy, wagging its tail and looking at what seems to be an opening in the wall. It turns out to be a painting, semi-abstract, propped up against the far corner. There's a glass covering the painting in which I can see my reflection. The dog continues to wag his tail. He's very happy and he has an erection. Gradually, the two images of the dog and myself begin to merge. And she awakes, thinking of the symbolism of this merger, feeling tremendously empowered, particularly about painting. She was an artist and she did go back to painting. And she had been, as many women in that era, she had been very reliant on men and lived in the shadow of a very famous man. So for her, this was a claiming of herself and her own power and fertility and joy. Now this is a dream about an eagle. And she told me this dream 1 year into the analysis. And what she told me is she had this dream the summer before she called me. So this was the dream that really essentially said to her, you must address your life and death. I'm in a field facing west, in the west. The land is flat and I can see for miles except for places behind brush, sagebrush, tumbleweed, and mesquite. She had been, by the way, she'd been visiting the Southwest. Her husband was doing a very creative project and she went to visit and she went horseback riding out into the desert. Suddenly I see an eagle with its wings spread out completely falling straight to the earth, surely to its death. There's blood on it, lots of it. It strikes the ground head first as it holds its wings out rigidly away from its body. Everyone gasps, both at the beauty of the creature and its size and perfection and the sight of its impending doom. But as soon as the bird hits the ground, it soars back up into the sky again rapidly, and we all see that a smaller bird, a hawk or a falcon, is following it from the exact spot where the eagle struck. The smaller bird is also bloodied, and the two do a ballet like this, repeating their rising and falling, following one another in turns. This is repeated two or three times, and each time the birds fall to the earth, they're behind some vegetation and cannot be seen. The final time we see the eagle rise into the sky and it is no longer followed by the dolphin. There's a feeling of utter triumph, of feeling, and I realize that I am the eagle. So as I said, she reported this dream about a year into the analysis, and that's what she did. She reported it. She had not embodied this dream. But in the week before she died, and we were revisiting dreams, and she wanted to work on this dream, and she read it, owned it, and embodied it, and really experienced an ascension. which was really wonderful. And she really was already kind of in some kind of a sense within days of her death. And the other thing is, during that week, she was so excited about this, she asked me to write something about it, and she asked another friend, an artist and an etcher who was there, if we would do a collaborative project. She has like 1 week to live, and she's still being creative. So this is what the etcher did, and it's about 3 feet by 4 feet. It's enormous, and it's beautiful. And this is a man who she studied etching with, and she studied typesetting and bookmaking. And she had a series of turtle dreams, and she etched the turtles, she wrote poetry, and she made a beautiful handmade book. I don't want to go too much into this. I'll say a little bit about the dream, my comments. The setting is a field facing west. This is an open, undefined natural space. Facing west would symbolically and in traditional terms be facing introversion, incubation, hibernation, and or death. West is also the place where the American psyche describes the pioneering spirit, the sense of open spaces and potential life. And in her family, her grandmother had gone west, and her grandmother was an artist and beloved by her. And this client had moved to California and lived there for years. So she literally did spend time in the West, but when she, it was about maybe 5 years before the end of her life, she wanted to come back to her roots in New England. She was trying to, during the time of this dream, she was actually trying to decide whether she was going to separate from her husband. It was a very critical transitional time in her life, and these animals came in her dreams. And symbolically, going into the desert represents a time of little external feeling. Going into the desert is traditionally and mythically a time of endurance, contemplation, psychological introversion, and confrontation with one's demons and temptations. The small groups of people are autonomous and non-interfering witnesses. There are some parts of her. The initial glimpsing of the eagle is shocking and sudden, just like glimpsing the divine can be, shocking, dramatic, and often violent. The eagle's engaged in an act that is utterly connected to death. It is terribly wounded and falling without any obstruction. How could any living thing survive this situation? In her dream, there was red that appeared as blood, and it was the first kind of glimpse of red I'd seen in her dreams. And that is the alchemical color of passion and the culmination of an embodied life. So I stored that along with the appearance of a regal spirit, which can also be related to Christ or Christ energy or heavenly realms, and it's the symbol of the United States. It's also a raptor, powerfully aggressive and predatory bird. When I heard the dream, I wondered why the spiritual instinct was wounded and why the spiritual instinct was colliding with the earth. The hawk or the falcon can also be known as a communicator and is also known as Horus, the rising sun or enlightener in Egyptian mythology. So it's not quite clear if they were in conflict or they were just there together, but they were in some sort of dance and tension. a ballet. And in dreams, when there's repetition, you know, you really pay attention. You know, what is this meaning? Or if something happens twice, or there's twins, or often the opposites are constellated. I wondered about the part about the seen and the unseen, how it goes behind the vegetation and we don't know what's happening. And this is also a theme in fairy tales and folklore, where when the divine is at work, you can't see it. You're not supposed to see it. And I also thought about this as the drama of the interrelationship, the dance of life and death. And the completion of the dream, there's a feeling of total triumph and identification with the spiritual ascent. I didn't know, but it may have foreshadowed her early death. So now that's one of the turtle etchings. And I'm not going to read the turtle dreams because we're not really going to have time. But I'll just give you a little hint of the way the turtles came. There's a large field that I have been caring for. It's flat and golden with a new crop of whatever's been planted. I go back and forth between my gardening and farming choice to a small structure where I take meals with others. Emma is there. Emma was her childhood friend who she's known all her life. Emma's also an artist. She knows about my interest in turtles, and I tell her I've seen a small one. One time, as I'm leaving the communal eating place in the evening and headed toward the field where I sleep, I see an enormous turtle gliding over a ditch and up in the embankment coming toward me. Emma said the turtle's looking for me, wants to see me, had come to see me. I'm so happy to have another visitation. I think there must have been two visitations in the dream, and the next time I see the turtle, he's coming toward me in the field from another direction, moving again without the characteristic lumbering. He's gliding, he lands, and he snuggles with her. And in the dream, she sort of pulls back and says, "Are you for real?" And, you know. And in several dreams, she speaks to her friend Emma and gets affirmation. And she also likes to take photographs in the dream of something unusual is happening. It's like she wants to fix the image and bring it back to consciousness so other people can see what she's experiencing in the psyche. It's very interesting. I've never known anybody who did that. So anyway, she did go on. She wrote a beautiful poem that had to do with holding still in the face of pain. And she made this book, and this is just one of about 10 etchings in it. And she made 10 copies of the book, and she gave me one. And she had a cat. And the cat's name was Turtle. So I'd just like to say, this is not an earth turtle. It defies gravity. It's a magical turtle. So not only is a turtle a wild creature and fairly archaic, but it's magical. So when things appear like that, I know that we're talking about a very deep level of the psyche. You know, if it's a companion animal like a dog or a cat or a personal horse, we're up at the much more a level of everyday life and often a lot of personal memory. And when we're dreaming of wild animals, we're going deeper into our archaic psyche. Elephants, reptiles, etc. And then some people even dream of half animal, half other creature, half person, etc. So this is truly in the mythic, deep psyche. Universally, the turtle represents the earth. This is Turtle Island in the Native American view. The turtle has a phallic head and neck and a round feminine body, making it the carrier of opposites of masculine and feminine. It has the capacity to totally withdraw into itself, total introversion. And it represents the slow and steady pace of evolution that carries all history in its shell. Much like our own body, all our history is held in the cells and in the body. The turtle is also often related to Mother Earth, and we're all carried on her back, on her shell. This particular mysterious creature is seeking her, specifically, and she has no fear. And this is also unusual. And she totally embraces the experience, and I saw that over and over again, where she totally embraced the experience, even some of the uglier, more frightening experiences. And that was an attitude she had, an openness that was quite wonderful. And she wants to record this mysterious visitation via camera so she can bring it back from the unconscious to share with others. Animal experiences like this have an aboriginal shamanic quality, very old, wise, and directly out of the depths of mystery. An experience like the turtle dreams was so energizing, and fortunately she had a great deal of creativity, and she really let it flow. She didn't keep it stopped up in her body. The experience of making art can have a similar quality to the turtle's arrival in Lara's dream. It simply and mysteriously comes to the artist, who, if ready and available, can express his or her vision. It's also helpful to be open and curious and embrace the experience. I'm sharing this one for a couple reasons, and this is in the fourth year, this is sort of midway in her analysis. I'm sitting beside a young man, we're both in our 20s, we're youthful. Something extraordinary has happened, maybe even cataclysmic, and we are left to care for the life that is left, to nurture the young animals remaining. I look to my left toward the young man and hand him an infant. He holds it to his breast, and the baby immediately puts its mouth on the man's breast and starts nursing. I'm amazed and thrilled to see this is possible. I say, "I didn't know you could do that, but I see how natural it seems." And the young man takes this completely in stride. I then take another creature in my arms and I look down to the baby's face and I see it has a trunk of a miniature elephant. It's a tiny elephant. The trunk moves immediately to my right breast, which is where she didn't have a right breast anymore. She had the mastectomy, the radical mastectomy. So it moves immediately to her right breast and reaching through the white shirt I'm wearing. Look how well this is working. It really helps to have a trunk. So, and a number of her dreams really have wonderful humor. I think elephants have at least 200 muscles in their trunk. They're really quite I'd say far more interesting than even a hand, possibly. And elephants touch a lot. When they meet, they touch. And they touch the bones of their relatives that have died. So in this dream, there's the notion that we're all survivors and all charged with fashioning a new way to be in life that will be different from what we've known before. In both cases, the young man's and hers, the nurturing person doesn't have to have a female breast. Humans can nurture the young of all species. In analytic psychology, the infant or baby in dreams is associated with the archetype of the conscious self in its nascent form. It's like a second or symbolic birth, which represents the capacity to be of the spirit and not just of the physical. The baby is a symbol of the creative, of the future, of life moving onwards. The baby appearing can also represent our infant experiences, such as falling between the cracks, even literally, or our infant experiences of not being seen or nurtured, being neglected. Analysands often have at least one of these dreams heralding the birth of the conscious self within. In the dream, each is charged and challenged by the psyche to hold, not just in the dream, but each of us is charged and challenged by the psyche to hold, to see, to keep, to protect, and nourish the developing self. This dream is one of a series in her life of babies that I watched this process. Laura's particular dilemma had to do with the loss of physical integrity. Aspects of her self-doubt contributed to an early cancer diagnosis of hepatitis C at age 28. One of the things she did, and I had never seen this before because I didn't have any close friends or relatives, but she had her mastectomy in the late 50s, early 60s, and she just lifted up her shirt to show me, and it was a really radical disfiguring surgery. When a patient can nourish herself via both genders, masculine and feminine capacities, and transcend old beliefs about the way life should be, we see a profound and successful drive toward integration of the psyche. The interdependence of species, here mammals, is understood. She accepts and nourishes her instinctual life. Life wants to go on to evolve. It is the task of each of us to carry on and participate in this evolution. Prescient. By the way, after I had put these on a flash drive and I didn't want to mess with it, I found a wonderful picture of baby Ganesh being nursed by his mother. It was very much like the image in the dream. She continued dreaming up to her last month of life. In her last year, the eighth year, quite uncharacteristically, months did pass without the capacity to remember dreams. And this is the vision of, wish I had a blank slide here, but the vision of the deer, death approaches. And this is a note on what happened. It's not a dream. It's the last morning that Laura walked exactly 2 days before she died. This was the moment when she fell to her knees. This was the moment of her vision of the deer. Having such a vision can be an ancient herald of death in many cultures and a guide for the departing soul. The approach was swift, quiet, and filled with awesome beauty. In the tiny bathroom with the pine wood Dutch door, just 17 slow steps from her recently arranged library bedroom on the first floor, in this tiny chamber bathroom, Laura calculated by the hour her body's withdrawal from the world via measuring cups. She would measure how much fluid went in and how much fluid went out, and she was really getting a sense. She was quite alert and aware of what was happening. She didn't give up hope. She glanced up through the window to the Berkshire mountain woods blanketed in snow. And calling me, I kneeled near her. She's sitting on the toilet, just sitting. I kneeled and she whispered her vision, her epiphany. Oh, Penny, I've seen the deer. It's broken through the snow and ice, and it's drinking deeply from the cold waters. I knew that Laura had been unable to eat or drink for days, and now she was dying of dehydration. Then, in complete openness, she passionately prayed aloud for the earth, the rivers, for all lives, and the planet's well-being. And there is a glory when a human reaches full supplication. She was living now through the vision and through the deer. Her dying was so like birthing, breath and focus, into realms unseen by us, her spirit moved through us physically as she left. It's very, very peaceful, profound death. About 6 months before she died, she recorded this dream, but she never reported it during analysis. This is very unusual for her. She had given me her journals, and I found it in the last journal, the 20th journal. And she asked me to gather those journals in the weeks before she died and take them home with me and write from them. And this dream, this last dream, speaks of the religious function of the psyche and the psyche's wonderful humor and her coming to terms with life and death. So this is the final dream, a visitation. I come to a place where messages and mail have collected. As I glance at the postcards, and this is what's written, we have stopped by several times to see you, but you're not here. That's in here. And she's thinking, who is this? An unknown man comes by. He is obviously pushing something. He comes to me, and I know I don't want to spend time with him. And as he speaks, he pushes a 1-inch oval-framed image of Christ into my hand and asks me if I will accept it. And I say, of course. The man looks relieved and moves on. Later, I'm sitting on my cot with my lap piled with mail, and the little Christ souvenir slips down off my lap. I gather the mail together and lay it together with some treasured find. She used to collect, when she was hiking, if she found a dead bird, she would bring it and put it in the freezer and then spend time sketching it and studying the feathers and studying the structure, etc. So those are treasured finds. The dead bodies, lay the mail down together with some treasured finds, the dead bodies of some small rodents and bats. And as soon as I lay down the mail, they, the creatures, come to life. It's as if they've just awakened from a deep sleep. I'm quite surprised, and for a moment I wonder if this has anything to do with my accepting the Christ token. I think this is silly, but I can't be sure. I'm drawn to the animals and feel that they teach me everything I need to know. So, I never got to talk to her about this, of course, but I thought it was wonderful that she kept this as a secret for herself. She had come to a place where the messages had been collected. Perhaps they were related to analysis, but mostly deeply from the self. Someone, someones, are trying to communicate with her, mysterious other visitation, and a visit by an unknown stranger, a messenger of Christ. She never discussed her relationship with the figure of Christ, with the religion of Christ, but I knew it was her childhood experience. In this dream, there was a return to the archetypal religious figure from her early childhood. The Christ is related to resurrection, or the return to life after suffering, a brutal physical death, and the experience of abandonment. This is the great intersection of material flesh and spirit, a heart-centered experience of profound love and acceptance. Laura accepts the Christ in the little mandorla, though it slips away. She tends her respect for and curiosity of nature, here in the form of death. Christ consciousness arises via the heart, via grace. It cannot be willed or manipulated into consciousness. Such human identification with holiness eclipses personal ego-centered consciousness. And the night before her death, she experiences grace and awe. This dream is an example of someone who really loved animals and nature and art. And nature was her teacher, and it was her way to the divine, and it was her way to the body and the healing of the issues of her body. The mysteries are below, these are the mysteries that are below collective religion, and they led her into her body and heart. Nature offered an epiphany, a realization of the divine, while Lara was still here and preparing for the transition into death. They, the animal nature, teach me everything I need to know. And I just like to say I have great gratitude for her openness and what she shared and how she included me, because it was, I was a help, but I learned, so it was an initiation for me. So I had given this little dream as the advertisement, and I thought I would just add it here because it's a little bit different. And I'm going to close with dreams with this one. And this is a dream about two birds. I'm traveling alone and stop at a small, simple motel that seems to be in the southwest. It's dry and dusty there and seems to be built into the side of a hill. I'm sitting in my room on the edge of the bed with two, this is not her dream, it's another patient, with two small brown birds, one in each palm of my outstretched hand, bent at the elbow. They seem humble like sparrows. It appears like a mudra or a gesture of openness with palms up. You can try to feel that, if you could just feel that in your own body. Okay? As I hold them, the one on the right is very alive. I feel the soft feathers and its tiny, fast heartbeat. The one in my left hand is also soft but seems stunned or dead. I sit holding them for some time. When it's time to go, I place the birds on the bed and gather myself, packing or loading up. Later, I return to the room to check on the birds. Entering the room, they're both well, singing, chirping, and hopping on the bed. I notice that someone, an unknown figure, a helping force, seems like a masculine handyman or motel owner, has entered the room while I was out and opened the two windows. They are securely propped open with pieces of wood, like 2x4s or sticks, but they're wood. Yet the birds are not fleeing, not flying away. They're hopping about with the fresh air coming in and light. They have the choice and opportunity to fly away, yet they haven't. They're a pair. And these are the comments upon the dreamer. Upon waking, I realize that I have surrendered the birds, put them on the bed, knowing that it was beyond my capacity raising the dead, and I let nature, the mystery, take its course. So that was a surrender of the heroic ego, among other things. And as I was getting ready for this and reading about birds and epiphanies and shamans, I found this very ancient Mongolian shaman. And there you see the two little birds on the top of his pole, and they are mediators to the heavenly realms. And the poles that he's holding are also symbolic of the divine tree of nature. So the shaman is often one who can move in all realms and he often will retrieve pieces of the person, of the soul. His job is different from being an analyst. And I would say my own experience is that we all have shaman within us, and it's something we developed. We develop over time, but we are our own shaman. And I mean, there are shamans that do other things externally, but I believe we have that shamanic capacity to travel to other realms and retrieve parts of ourselves. And So she who travels between worlds. So the last thing I wanted to show you from this patient is this is the last photograph she took, and she's an excellent photographer, so this is a very rare thing to see something all fuzzy and smudged like this, but it was a picture of a deer fleeing, disappearing into the woods. And she took this about 6 months before she died. So we're back with our hoof prints, our tracks in the snow, and I feel it is our task to notice and follow the dream if we wish to truly know thyself, the Delphic inscription. So thank you. And we have a few minutes for thoughts and questions. The turtle is related to Mother Earth holding all of us on her back, and the turtle has the capacity, yes, for extreme introversion, withdrawing into itself. It also carries its entire history on its back, in its shell, much the way we do. But it has a rather phallic head and neck. It can stretch out, and it has a round, often domed body. So it is this very marvelous integration of the masculine and feminine. One of the longest living creatures, slow evolution, and I know 8 years sounds like a long time, or training analysis, you know, long time, but you know that evolution is not quick. It doesn't happen quickly, and it takes a real dedication. So, does that answer the question about turtle?
I had a series of dreams in my late 20s where I was really around, and I was also around waking dream also, turtle medicine and owl medicine. And, you know, I have my own interpretation, but I didn't know we could talk about owl.
I didn't, but I have a Mary Oliver poem I was thinking of closing with. Other questions or comments? So this is the end here. This is Mary Oliver, and it's called White Owl Flies Into and Out of the Field. Coming down out of the freezing sky with its depths of light, like an angel, or a Buddha with wings, it was beautiful and accurate, striking the snow and whatever was there with a force that left the imprint of the tips of its wings, 5 feet apart, and the grabbing thrust of its feet and the indentation of what had been running through the white valleys of the snow. Then it rose gracefully and flew back into the frozen marshes to lurk there, like a little lighthouse in the blue shadows, so I thought. Maybe death isn't darkness after all, but so much light wrapping itself around us, soft as feathers, that we are instantly weary of looking and looking, and shut our eyes, not without amazement, and let ourselves be carried as though the translucence of mica to the river, that is without the least dapple or shadow, that is nothing but light, scalding atoral light, in which we are washed and washed out of our bones. There's Alan.
Penny, do you want to say a few words about what you're going to do tomorrow?
Tomorrow it'll be much more personal, and people will have a chance to introduce themselves and bring up some of their own animal experiences and their own dreams. And I will go more into the symbology of different animal kingdoms and mythical animals, and so it'll be a deepening, and it'll be more personal, and people will get to know each other. But hopefully we'll get to work on some dreams too. So that's at 9 o'clock, and we'll stop somewhere between 12:30 and 1, see how we're doing.
So if you want to let Penny know if you're interested, or sign this, and it's in room 105. Okay. And if you want to join us at the Mosaic Cafe for a little more talk and a cup of tea before you go off into the dark, please come. So thank you, Penny.